This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Shoe Dog, a memoir by the creator of Nike, by Phil Knight. Read by Norbert Leo Butts, with an introduction read by the author.
Dawn. I was up before the others, before the birds, before the sun. I drank a cup of coffee, wolfed down a piece of toast, put on my shorts and sweatshirt, and laced up my green running shoes, then slipped quietly out the back door. I stretched my legs, my hamstrings, my lower back, and groaned as I took the first few balky steps down the cool road into the fog. Why is it always so hard to get started? There were no cars, no people, no signs of life. I was all alone, the world to myself, though the trees seemed oddly aware of me. Then again, this was Oregon. The trees always seemed to know. The trees always had your back. What a beautiful place to be from, I thought, gazing around. Calm, green, tranquil. I was proud to call Oregon my home, proud to call little Portland my place of birth, but I felt a stab of regret, too. Though beautiful, Oregon struck some people as the kind of place where nothing big had ever happened or was ever likely to. If we Oregonians were famous for anything, it was an old, old trail we'd had to blaze to get here. Since then, things have been pretty tame. The best teacher I ever had, one of the finest men I ever knew, spoke of the trail often. "It's our birthright," he'd growl, "our character, our fate, our DNA. The cowards never started," he'd tell me, "and the weak died along the way. That leaves us. Us." Some rare atavistic strain of pioneer spirit was discovered along that trail, my teacher believed. Some outside sense of possibility mixed with a diminished capacity for pessimism. And it was our job as Oregonians to keep that strain alive. I'd nod, showing him all due respect. I loved the guy, but walking away I'd sometimes think, "Jeez, it's just a dirt road." That foggy morning, that momentous morning, in 1962, I'd recently blazed my own trail, back home after 7 long years away. It was strange being home again, strange being lashed again by the daily rains. Stranger still was living again with my parents and twin sisters, sleeping in my childhood bed. Late at night, I'd lie on my back, staring at my college textbooks, my high school trophies and blue ribbons, thinking, "This is me? Still?" I moved quicker down the road, my breath formed rounded, frosty puffs swirling into the fog. I savored the first physical awakening, that brilliant moment before the mind is fully clear, when the limbs and joints first begin to loosen and the material body starts to melt away, solid to liquid. "Faster," I told myself, "faster." On paper, I thought, I'm an adult. Graduated from a good college, University of Oregon. Earned a master's from a top business school, Stanford. Survived a year-long hitch in the U.S. Army, Fort Lewis and Fort Eustis. My resume said I was learned, an accomplished soldier, a 24-year-old man in full. But why, I wondered, why do I still feel like a kid? Worse, the same shy, pale, rail-thin kid I'd always been. Maybe because I still hadn't experienced anything of life. Least of all, its many temptations and excitements. I hadn't smoked a cigarette, hadn't tried a drug. I hadn't broken a rule, let alone a law. The 1960s were just underway, the age of rebellion, and I was the only person in America who hadn't yet rebelled. I couldn't think of one time I'd cut loose, done the unexpected. I'd never even been with a girl. If I tended to dwell on all the things I wasn't, the reason was simple. Those were the things I knew best. I'd have found it difficult to say what or who exactly I was or might become. Like all my friends, I wanted to be successful. Unlike my friends, I didn't know what that meant. Money? Maybe. Wife? Kids? House? Sure, if I was lucky. These were the goals I was taught to aspire to, and part of me did aspire to them, instinctively. But deep down I was searching for something else, something more. I had an aching sense that our time is short, shorter than we ever know, short as a morning run, and I wanted mine to be meaningful, and purposeful, and creative, and important. Above all, different. I wanted to leave a mark on the world. I wanted to win. No, that's not right. I simply didn't want to lose. And then it happened. As my strong young heart began to thump, as my pink lungs expanded like the wings of a bird, as the trees turned to greenish blurs, I saw it all before me, exactly what I wanted my life to be. Play. Yes, I thought, that's it. That's the word. The secret of happiness I'd always suspected, the essence of beauty or truth, or all we ever need to know of either, lay somewhere in that moment when the ball is in midair, when both boxers sense the approach of the bell, when the runner's near the finish line and the crowd rises as one. There's a kind of exuberance and clarity and central meaning in the pulsing half-second before winning and losing are decided. I wanted that, whatever that was, to be my life, my daily life. At different times, I'd fantasized about being a great novelist, a great journalist, a great statesman. But the ultimate dream was always to be a great athlete. Sadly, fate had made me good, not great. At 24, I was finally resigned to that fact. I'd run track at Oregon, and I'd distinguished myself lettering 3 of the 4 years. But that was that, the end. Now, as I began to clip off one brisk 6-minute mile after another, as the rising sun set fire to the lowest needles of the pines, I asked myself, what if there was a way, without being an athlete, to feel what athletes feel, to play all the time instead of working, or else to enjoy work so much that it becomes essentially the same thing? The world was so overrun with war and pain and misery. The daily grind was so exhausting and often unjust. Maybe the only answer, I thought, was to find some prodigious, improbable dream that seemed worthy, that seemed fun, that seemed a good fit, and chase it with an athlete's single-minded dedication and purpose. Like it or not, life is a game. Whoever denies that truth, whoever simply refuses to play, gets left on the sidelines, and I didn't want that. More than anything, that was the thing I did not want. Which led, as always, to my crazy idea. Maybe, I thought, just maybe, I need to take one more look at my crazy idea. Maybe my crazy idea just might work. Maybe. No, no, I thought, running faster and faster, running as if I were chasing someone and being chased all at the same time. It will work. By God, I'll make it work. No maybes about it. I was suddenly smiling, almost laughing. Drenched in sweat, moving as gracefully and effortlessly as I ever had, I saw my crazy idea shining up ahead, and it didn't look all that crazy. It didn't even look like an idea. It looked like a place. It looked like a person or some life force that existed long before I did, separate from me, but also a part of me, waiting for me, but also hiding from me. That might sound a little high-flown, a little crazy, but that's how I felt back then. Or maybe I didn't. Maybe my memory is enlarging this eureka moment, condensing many eureka moments into one. Or maybe, if there was such a moment, it was nothing more than a runner's high. I don't know. I can't say. So much about those days and months and years into which they slowly sorted themselves has vanished, like those rounded, frosty puffs of breath. Faces, numbers, decisions that once seemed eternal and irrevocable, they're all gone. What remains, however, is this one sliver of certainty, this one shining truth that will never go away. At 24, I did have a crazy idea, and somehow, despite being dizzy with existential angst and fears about my future, as all young men and women in their mid-20s are, I did decide that the world is made up of crazy ideas. History is one long processional of crazy ideas. The things I love most, books, sports, democracy, free enterprise, started as crazy ideas. For that matter, few ideas are as crazy as my favorite thing, running. It's hard. It's painful. It's risky. The rewards are few and far from guaranteed. When you run around an oval track or down an empty road, you have no real destination, at least none that can fully justify the effort. The act itself becomes the destination. It's not just that there's no finish line. It's that you define the finish line. Whatever pleasure or gains you derive from the act of running, you must find them within. It's all in how you frame it, how you sell it to yourself. Every runner knows this. You run and run, mile after mile, and you never quite know why. You tell yourself that you're running towards some goal, chasing some rush, but really you run because the alternative, stopping, scares you to death. So that morning in 1962, I told myself, let everyone else call your idea crazy. Just keep going. Don't stop. Don't even think about stopping until you get there. And don't give much thought to where there is. Whatever comes, just don't stop. That's the precocious, prescient, urgent advice I managed to give myself out of the blue and somehow managed to take. Half a century later, I believe it's the best advice, maybe the only advice, any of us should ever give.
Part 1. Now here, you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that. Lewis Carroll, Through the Looking Glass. 1962. When I broached the subject with my father, when I worked up the nerve to speak to him about my crazy idea, I made sure it was in the early evening. That was always the best time with Dad. He was relaxed then, well-fed, contented, stretched out in his vinyl recliner in the TV nook. I can still tilt back my head and close my eyes and hear the sound of the audience laughing, the tinny theme songs of his favorite shows, Wagon Train and Rawhide. His all-time favorite was Red Buttons. Every episode began with Red singing, "Ho, ho, hee, hee, strange things are happening." I set a straight-back chair beside him and gave a wan smile and waited for the next commercial. I'd rehearsed my spiel in my head over and over, especially the opening. "So, Dad, you remember that crazy idea I had at Stanford?" It was one of my final classes, a seminar on entrepreneurship. I'd written a research paper about shoes, and the paper had evolved from a run-of-the-mill assignment to an all-out obsession. Being a runner, I knew something about running shoes. Being a business buff, I knew that Japanese cameras had made deep cuts into the camera market, which had once been dominated by Germans. Thus, I argued in my paper that Japanese running shoes might do the same thing. The idea interested me, then inspired me, then captivated me. It seemed so obvious, so simple, so potentially huge. I'd spent weeks and weeks on that paper. I'd moved into the library, devoured everything I could find about importing and exporting, about starting a company. Finally, as required, I'd given a formal presentation of the paper to my classmates, who reacted with formal boredom. Not one asked a single question. They greeted my passion and intensity with labored sighs and vacant stares. The professor thought my crazy idea had merit. He gave me an A. But that's where it ended. At least that's where it was supposed to end. I'd never really stopped thinking about that paper. Through the rest of my time at Stanford, through every morning run and right up to that moment in the TV nook, I'd pondered going to Japan, finding a shoe company, pitching them my crazy idea, in the hopes that they'd have a more enthusiastic reaction than my classmates, that they'd want to partner with a shy, pale, rail-thin kid from sleepy Oregon. I'd also toyed with the notion of making an exotic detour on my way to and from Japan. How could I leave my mark on the world, I thought, unless I get out there first and see it? Before running a big race, you always want to walk the track. A backpacking trip around the globe might be just the thing, I reasoned. No one talked about bucket lists in those days, but I suppose that's close to what I had in mind. Before I died, became too old or consumed with everyday minutiae, I wanted to visit the planet's most beautiful and wondrous places, and its most sacred. Of course, I wanted to taste other foods, hear other languages, dive into other cultures, but what I really craved was some sort of connection with a capital C. I wanted to experience what the Chinese call Tao, the Greeks call Logos, the Hindus call Jnana, the Buddhists call Dharma, what the Christians call spirit. Before setting out on my own personal life voyage, I thought, let me first understand the greater voyage of humankind. Let me explore the grandest temples and churches and shrines, the holiest rivers and mountaintops. Let me feel the presence of God? Yes, I told myself, yes, for want of a better word, God. But first, I'd need my father's approval. More, I'd need his cash. I'd already mentioned making a big trip the previous year, and my father seemed open to it. But surely he'd forgotten, and surely I was pushing it, adding to the original proposal this crazy idea, this outrageous side trip to Japan? To launch a company? Talk about boondoggles. Surely he'd see this as a bridge too far. And a bridge too damned expensive. I had some savings from the Army and from various part-time jobs over the last several summers, on top of which I planned to sell my car, a cherry black 1960 MG with racing tires and a twin cam, the same car Elvis drove in Blue Hawaii, all of which amounted to $1,500, leaving me a grand short, I now told my father. He nodded, and flicked his eyes from the TV to me and back again while I laid it all out. Remember how we talked, Dad, how I said I wanted to see the world? The Himalayas, the pyramids? The Dead Sea, Dad? The Dead Sea? Well, I'm also thinking of stopping off in Japan, Dad. Remember my crazy idea, Japanese running shoes? Right? It could be huge, Dad. Huge. I was laying it on thick, putting on the hard sell, extra hard, because I always hated selling. And because this particular sell had zero chance. My father had just forked out hundreds of dollars to the University of Oregon, thousands more to Stanford. He was the publisher of the Oregon Journal, a solid job that paid for all the basic comforts, including our spacious white house on Claiborne Street, in Portland's quietest suburb, Eastmoreland. But the man wasn't made of money. Also, this was 1962. The Earth was bigger then. Though humans were beginning to orbit the planet in capsules, 90% of Americans still had never been on an airplane. The average man or woman had never ventured farther than 100 miles from his or her own front door. So the mere mention of global travel by airplane would unnerve any father, and especially mine, whose predecessor at the paper had died in an air crash. Setting aside money, setting aside safety concerns, the whole thing was just so impractical. I was aware that 26 of 27 new companies failed, and my father was aware too, and the idea of taking on such a colossal risk went against everything he stood for. In many ways, my father was a conventional Episcopalian, a believer in Jesus Christ. But he also worshipped another secret deity, respectability. Colonial house, beautiful wife, obedient kids. My father enjoyed having these things. But what he really cherished was his friends and neighbors knowing he had them. He liked being admired. He liked doing a vigorous backstroke each day in the mainstream. Going around the world on a lark, therefore, would simply make no sense to him. It wasn't done. Certainly not by the respectable sons of respectable men. It was something other people's kids did. Something beatniks and hipsters did. Possibly the main reason for my father's respectability fixation was a fear of his inner chaos. I felt this viscerally because every now and then that chaos would burst forth. Without warning, late at night, the phone in the front hall would jingle, and when I answered there would be that same gravelly voice on the line, "Come get your old man." I'd pull on my raincoat, it always seemed on those nights that a misting rain was falling, and drive downtown to my father's club. As clearly as I remember my own bedroom, I remember that club. A century-old, with floor-to-ceiling oak bookcases and wing-back chairs. It looked like the drawing room of an English country house. In other words, eminently respectable. I'd always find my father at the same table, in the same chair. I'd always help him gently to his feet. "You okay, Dad?"
"Of course I'm okay."
I'd always guide him outside to the car, and the whole way home we'd pretend nothing was wrong. He'd sit perfectly erect, almost regal, and we'd talk sports. Because talking sports was how I distracted myself, soothed myself in times of stress. My father liked sports, too. Sports were always respectable. For these and a dozen other reasons, I expected my father to greet my pitch in the TV nook with a furrowed brow and a quick put-down. "Ha ha! Crazy idea. Fat chance, Buck." My given name was Philip, but my father always called me Buck. In fact, he'd been calling me Buck since before I was born. My mother told me he'd been in the habit of patting her stomach and asking, "How's little Buck today?" As I stopped talking, however, as I stopped pitching, my father rocked forward in his vinyl recliner and shot me a funny look. He said that he always regretted not traveling more when he was young. He said a trip might be just the finishing touch to my education. He said a lot of things, all of them focused more on the trip than the crazy idea, but I wasn't about to correct him. I wasn't about to complain because in sum, he was giving me his blessing and his cash. "Okay," he said. "Okay, Buck. Okay." I thanked my father and fled the nook before he had a chance to change his mind. Only later did I realize with a stab of guilt that my father's lack of travel was an ulterior reason, perhaps the main reason, that I wanted to go. A trip around the world would be one sure way of becoming someone other than him, someone less respectable. Or maybe not less respectable, maybe just less obsessed with respectability. The rest of the family wasn't quite so supportive. When my grandmother got wind of my itinerary, one item in particular appalled her. "Japan!" she cried. "Why, Buck, it was only a few years ago the Japs were out to kill us, don't you remember? Pearl Harbor! The Japs tried to conquer the world! Some of them still don't know they lost! They're in hiding. They might take you prisoner, Buck. Gouge out your eyeballs. They're known for that. Your eyeballs!" I loved my mother's mother, whom we all called Mom Hatfield. And I understood her fear. Japan was about as far as you could get from Roseburg, Oregon, the farm town where she was born and where she'd lived all her life. I'd spent many summers down there with her and Pop Hatfield. Almost every night we'd sat out on the porch, listening to the croaking bullfrogs compete with the console radio, which in the early 1940s was always tuned to news of the war, which was always bad. The Japanese, we were told repeatedly, hadn't lost a war in 2,600 years, and it sure didn't seem they were going to lose this one either. In battle after battle, we suffered defeat after defeat. Finally, in 1942, Mutual Broadcasting's Gabriel Heater opened his nightly radio report with a shrill cry, "Good evening, everyone. There's good news tonight." The Americans had won a decisive battle at last. Critics skewered Heater for his shameless cheerleading, for abandoning all pretense of journalistic objectivity, but the public hatred of Japan was so intense, most people hailed Heater as a folk hero. Thereafter, he opened all broadcasts the same way. "Good news tonight." It's one of my earliest memories. Mom and Pop Hatfield beside me on the porch, Pop peeling a Gravenstein apple with his pocket knife, handing me a slice, then eating a slice, then handing me a slice, and so on, until his apple-paring pace slowed dramatically. Heater was coming on.
"Shh! Hush up!"
I can still see us all chewing apples and gazing at the night sky, so Japan-obsessed that we half expected to see Japanese Zeros crisscrossing the Dog Star. No wonder my first time on an airplane, right around 5 years old, I asked, "Dad, are the Japs going to shoot us down?" Though Mom Hatfield got the hair on my neck standing up, I told her not to worry. I'd be fine. I'd even bring her back a kimono. My twin sisters, Jean and Joanne, 4 years younger than me, didn't seem to care one way or another where I went or what I did. And my mother, as I recall, said nothing. She rarely did. But there was something different about her silence this time. It equaled consent, even pride. I spent weeks reading, planning, preparing for my trip. I went for long runs, musing on every detail while racing the wild geese as they flew overhead. Their tight V formations, I'd read somewhere that the geese in the rear of the formation, cruising in the backdraft, only have to work 80% as hard as the leaders. Every runner understands this. Front runners always work the hardest and risk the most. Long before approaching my father, I decided it would be good to have a companion on my travels, and that companion should be my Stanford classmate, Carter. Though he'd been a hoop star at William Jewell College, Carter wasn't your typical jock. He wore thick glasses and read books, good books. He was easy to talk to and easy not to talk to, equally important qualities in a friend, essential in a travel companion. But Carter laughed in my face. When I laid out the list of places I wanted to see, Hawaii, Tokyo, Hong Kong, Rangoon, Calcutta, Bombay, Saigon, Kathmandu, Cairo, Istanbul, Athens, Jordan, Jerusalem, Nairobi, Rome, Paris, Vienna, West Berlin, East Berlin, Munich, London, he rocked back on his heels and guffawed. Mortified, I looked down and began to make apologies. Then Carter, still laughing, said, "What a swell idea, Buck." I looked up. He wasn't laughing at me. He was laughing with joy, with glee. He was impressed. It took balls to put together an itinerary like that, he said. Balls. He wanted in. Days later, he got the okay from his parents, plus a loan from his father. Carter never did mess around. See an open shot? Take it. That was Carter. I told myself there was much I could learn from a guy like that as we circled the earth. We each packed one suitcase and one backpack. Only the bare necessities, we promised each other. A few pairs of jeans, a few t-shirts. Running shoes, desert boots, sunglasses, plus one pair of suntans, the 1960s word for khakis. I also packed one good suit, a green Brooks Brothers two-button, just in case my crazy idea came to fruition. September 7th, 1962. Carter and I piled into his battered old Chevy and drove at warp speed down I-5, through the Willamette Valley, out the wooded bottom of Oregon, which felt like plunging through the roots of a tree. We sped into the piney tip of California, up and over tall green mountain passes, then down, down, until long after midnight we swept into fog-cloaked San Francisco. For several days we stayed with some friends, sleeping on their floor. And then we swung by Stanford and fetched a few of Carter's things out of storage. Finally, we stopped at a liquor store and bought two discounted tickets on Standard Airlines to Honolulu. One way, $80. It felt like only minutes later that Carter and I were stepping onto the sandy tarmac of Oahu Airport. We wheeled and looked at the sky and thought, that is not the sky back home. A line of beautiful girls came toward us. Soft-eyed, olive-skinned, barefoot. They had double-jointed hips with which they twitched and whipped their grass skirts in our faces. Carter and I looked at each other and slowly grinned. We took a cab to Waikiki Beach and checked into a motel directly across the street from the sea. In one motion, we dropped our bags and pulled on our swim trunks. Race you to the water. As my feet hit the sand, I whooped and laughed and kicked off my sneakers, then sprinted directly into the waves. I didn't stop until I was up to my neck in the foam. I dove to the bottom, all the way to the bottom, and then came up gasping, laughing, and rolled onto my back. At last, I stumbled onto the shore and plopped onto the sand, smiling at the water and the birds and the clouds. I must have looked like an escaped mental patient. Carter, sitting beside me now, wore the same daffy expression. "We should stay here," I said. "Why be in a hurry to leave?" "What about the plan?" Carter said. "Going around the world." "Plans change." Carter grinned. "Swell idea, Buck." So we got jobs selling encyclopedias door to door. Not glamorous, to be sure, but heck, we didn't start work until 7 p.m., which gave us plenty of time for surfing. Suddenly, nothing was more important than learning to surf. After only a few tries, I was able to stay upright on a board, and after a few weeks, I was good. Really good. Gainfully employed, We ditched our motel room and signed a lease on an apartment, a furnished studio with two beds, one real, one fake, a sort of ironing board that folded out from the wall. Carter, being longer and heavier, got the real bed, and I got the ironing board. I didn't care. After a day of surfing and selling encyclopedias, followed by a night at the local bars, I could have slept in a luau fire pit. The rent was $100 a month, which we split down the middle. Life was grand. Life was heaven. Except for one small thing. I couldn't sell encyclopedias. I couldn't sell encyclopedias to save my life. The older I got, it seemed, the shyer I got, and the sight of my extreme discomfort often made strangers uncomfortable. Thus, selling anything would have been challenging, but selling encyclopedias, which were about as popular in Hawaii as mosquitoes in mainlanders, was an ordeal. No matter how deftly or forcefully I managed to deliver the key phrases drilled into us during our brief training session, "Boys, tell the folks you ain't selling encyclopedias. You're selling a vast compendium of human knowledge, the answers to life's questions." I always got the same response. "Beat it, kid." If my shyness made me bad at selling encyclopedias, my demon made me despise it. I wasn't built for heavy doses of rejection. I'd known this about myself since high school, freshman year, when I got cut from the baseball team. A small setback in the grand scheme, but it knocked me sideways. It was my first real awareness that not everyone in this world will like us or accept us, that we're often cast aside at the very moment we most need to be included. I will never forget that day. Dragging my bat along the sidewalk, I staggered home and locked myself in my room, where I grieved and moped for about 2 weeks until my mother appeared on the edge of my bed and said, "Enough." She urged me to try something else. "Like what?" I groaned into my pillow. "How about track?" she said. "Track?" I said. "You can run fast, Buck." "I can," I said, sitting up. So I went out for track. And I found that I could run. And no one could take that away. Now I gave up selling encyclopedias and all the old familiar rejection that went with it. And I turned to the want ads. In no time, I spotted a small ad inside a thick black border. "Wanted, security salesman." I certainly figured to have better luck selling securities. After all, I had an MBA. And before leaving home, I'd had a pretty successful interview with Dean Witter. I did some research and found that this job had two things going for it. First, it was with Investors Overseas Services, which was headed by Bernard Kornfeld, one of the most famous businessmen of the 1960s. Second, it was located in the top floor of a beautiful beachside tower. 20-foot windows overlooking the vast turquoise sea. Both of these things appealed to me and made me press hard in the interview. Somehow, after weeks of being unable to talk anyone into buying an encyclopedia, I talked Team Kornfeld into taking a flyer on me. Kornfeld's extraordinary success, plus that breathtaking ocean view, made it possible most days to forget that the firm was nothing more than a boiler room. Kornfeld was notorious for asking his employees if they sincerely wanted to be rich. And every day a dozen wolfish young men demonstrated that they did. They sincerely did. With ferocity, with abandon, they crashed the phones, cold calling prospects, scrambling desperately to arrange face-to-face meetings. I wasn't a smooth talker. I wasn't any kind of talker. Still, I knew numbers, and I knew the product, Dreyfus Funds. More, I knew how to speak the truth. People seemed to like that. I was quickly able to schedule a few meetings and to close a few sales. Inside a week, I'd earned enough in commissions to pay my half of the rent for the next 6 months, plus a few extra bucks for surfboard wax. Most of my discretionary income went to the dive bars along the water. Tourists tended to hang out in the grand resorts, the ones with names like Incantations, the Moana, the Halekulani, but Carter and I preferred the dives. We liked to sit with our fellow beachniks and surf bums, seekers and vagabonds, feeling smug about the one thing we had in our favor, geography. "Those poor suckers back home," we'd say. "Those poor saps sleepwalking through their humdrum lives, bundled against the cold and rain. Why can't they be more like us? Why can't they seize the day?" Our sense of carpe diem was heightened by the fact that the world was coming to an end. A nuclear standoff with the Soviets had been building for weeks. The Soviets had 36 missiles in Cuba, the United States wanted them out, and both sides had made their final offer. Negotiations were over, and World War III was set to begin any minute. According to the newspapers, missiles would fall from the sky later today, tomorrow at the latest. The world was Pompeii, and the volcano was already spitting ash. Ah, well, everyone in the dive bars agreed. When humanity ends, this will be as good a place as any to watch the rising mushroom clouds. Aloha, civilization. And then, surprise, the world was spared. The crisis passed. The sky seemed to sigh with relief as the air turned suddenly crisper, calmer. A perfect Hawaiian autumn followed, days of contentment and something close to bliss, followed by a sharp restlessness. One night I set my beer on the bar and turned to Carter. "I think maybe the time has come to leave Shangri-La," I said. I didn't make a hard pitch. I didn't think I had to. It was clearly time to get back to the plan. But Carter frowned and stroked his chin. "Gee, Buck, I don't know." He'd met a girl. A beautiful Hawaiian teenager with long brown legs and jet black eyes. The kind of girl who'd met our airplane. The kind I dreamed of having and never would. He wanted to stick around, and how could I argue? I told him I understood. But I was cast low. I left the bar and went for a long walk on the beach. Game over, I told myself. The last thing I wanted was to pack up and return to Oregon. But I couldn't see traveling around the world alone either. "Go home," a faint inner voice told me. "Get a normal job. Be a normal person." Then I heard another faint voice, equally emphatic. "No, don't go home. Keep going. Don't stop." The next day, I gave my 2 weeks' notice at the boiler room. "Too bad, Buck," one of the bosses said. "You had a real future as a salesman." "God forbid," I muttered. That afternoon at a travel agency down the block, I purchased an open plane ticket, good for 1 year on any airline going anywhere. A sort of your rail pass in the sky. On Thanksgiving Day, 1962, I hoisted my backpack and shook Carter's hand. "Buck," he said, "don't take any wooden nickels." The captain addressed the passengers in rapid-fire Japanese, and I started to sweat. I looked out the window at the blazing red circle on the wing. Mom Hatfield was right, I thought. We were just at war with these people. Corregidor, the Bataan Death March, the rape of Nanking, and now I was going there on some sort of business venture? Crazy idea? Maybe I was, in fact, crazy. If so, it was too late to seek professional help. The plane was screeching down the runway, roaring above Hawaii's cornstarch beaches. I looked down at the massive volcanoes growing smaller and smaller. No turning back. Since it was Thanksgiving, the in-flight meal was turkey, stuffing, and cranberry sauce. Since we were bound for Japan, there was also raw tuna, miso soup, and hot sake. I ate it all while reading the paperbacks I'd stuffed into my carry-on. The Catcher in the Rye and Naked Lunch. I identified with Holden Caulfield, the teenage introvert seeking his place in the world. But Burroughs went right over my head. "The junk merchant doesn't sell his product to the consumer. He sells the consumer to his product." Too rich for my blood. I passed out. When I woke, we were in a steep, rapid descent. Below us lay a startlingly bright Tokyo. The Ginza in particular was sparkling like a Christmas tree. Driving to my hotel, however, I saw only darkness. Vast sections of the city were a total liquid black. "War," the cab driver said. "Many buildings still bomb." Over a span of several nights in the summer of 1944, American B-29 superfortresses dropped 750,000 pounds of bombs, most filled with gasoline and flammable jelly. One of the world's oldest cities, Tokyo was made largely of wood, so the bomb set off a hurricane of fire. Some 300,000 people were burned alive, instantly, four times the number who died in Hiroshima. More than 1 million were gruesomely injured, and nearly 80% of the buildings were vaporized. For long, solemn stretches, the cab driver and I said nothing. There was nothing to say. Finally, the driver stopped at the address written in my notebook, a dingy hostel, beyond dingy. I'd made the reservation through American Express, sight unseen, a mistake I now realized. I crossed the pitted sidewalk and entered a building that seemed about to implode. An old Japanese woman behind the front desk bowed to me. I realized she wasn't bowing, she was bent by age, like a tree that's weathered many storms. Slowly, she led me to my room, which was more a box. Tatami mat, lopsided table, nothing else. I didn't care. I barely noticed that the tatami mat was wafer thin. I bowed to the bent old woman, bidding her good night. Oyasumi nasai. I curled up on the mat and passed out. Hours later, I woke in a room flooded with light. I crawled to the window. Apparently, I was in an industrial area on the city's fringe. Filled with docks and factories, this district must have been a primary target of the B-29s. Everywhere I looked was desolation, buildings cracked and broken, block after block simply leveled, gone. Luckily, my father knew people in Tokyo, including a group of American guys working at United Press International. I took a cab there and the guys greeted me like family. They gave me coffee and a breakfast ring, and when I told them where I'd spent the night, they laughed. They booked me into a clean, decent hotel. Then they wrote down the names of several good places to eat. What in God's name are you doing in Tokyo? I explained that I was going around the world. Then I mentioned my crazy idea. Huh, they said, giving a little eye roll. They mentioned two ex-GIs who ran a monthly magazine called Importer. Talk to the fellows at Importer, they said, before you do anything rash. I promised I would. But first, I wanted to see the city. Guidebook and Minolta box camera in hand, I sought out the few landmarks that had survived the war, the oldest temples and shrines. I spent hours sitting on benches in walled gardens, reading about Japan's dominant religions, Buddhism and Shinto. I marveled at the concept of Kensho, or Satori, enlightenment that comes in a flash, a blinding pop, sort of like the bulb on my Minolta. I like that. I wanted that. But first, I need to change my whole approach. I was a linear thinker, and according to Zen, linear thinking is nothing but a delusion, one of the many that keep us unhappy. Reality is non-linear, Zen says. No future, no past. All is now. In every religion, it seemed, self is the obstacle, the enemy. And yet Zen declares plainly that the self doesn't exist. Self is a mirage, a fever dream, and our stubborn belief in its reality not only wastes life, but shortens it. Self is the bald-faced lie we tell ourselves daily, and happiness requires seeing through the lie, debunking it. To study the self, said the 13th century Zen master Dogen, is to forget the self. Inner voice, outer voices, it's all the same. No dividing lines. Especially in competition. Victory, Zen says, comes when we forget the self and the opponent, who are but two halves of one whole. In Zen and the Art of Archery, it's all laid out with crystal clarity. Perfection in the art of swordsmanship is reached when the heart is troubled by no more thought of I and you, of the opponent and his sword, of one's own sword and how to wield it. All is emptiness. Your own self, the flashing sword, and the arms that wield it. Even the thought of emptiness is no longer there. My head swimming, I decided to take a break, to visit a very un-Zen-like landmark, in fact, the most anti-Zen place in Japan, an enclave where men focused on self and nothing but self, the Tokyo Stock Exchange. Housed in a marble Romanesque building with great big Greek columns, the Tosho looked from across the street like a stodgy bank in a quiet town in Kansas. Inside, however, all was bedlam. Hundreds of men waving their arms, pulling their hair, screaming, a more frantic version of Kornfeld's boiler room. I couldn't look away. I watched and watched, asking myself, Is this what it's all about? Really? I appreciated money as much as the next guy, but I wanted my life to be about so much more. After the Tosho, I needed peace. I went deep into the silent heart of the city, to the garden of the 19th century Emperor Meiji and his Empress, a space thought to possess immense spiritual power. I sat there, contemplative, reverent, beneath the swaying ginkgo trees, beside a beautiful Torii gate. I read in my guidebook that a Torii gate is usually a portal to sacred places, and so I basked in the sacredness, the serenity, trying to soak it all in. The next morning, I laced up my running shoes and jogged to Tsukiji, the world's largest fish market. It was the Tosho all over again, with shrimp instead of stocks. I watched ancient fishermen spread their catches onto wooden carts and haggle with leather-faced merchants. That night, I took a bus up to the lakes region, in the northern Hakone Mountains, an area that inspired many of the great Zen poets. "You cannot travel the path until you have become the path yourself," said the Buddha. And I stood in awe before a path that twisted from the glassy lakes to cloud-ringed Mount Fuji, a perfect snow-clad triangle that looked to me exactly like Mount Hood back home. The Japanese believe climbing Fuji is a mystical experience, a ritual act of celebration, and I was overcome with a desire to climb it right then. I wanted to ascend into the clouds. I decided to wait, however. I would return when I had something to celebrate. I went back to Tokyo and presented myself at Importer. The two ex-GIs in charge, thick-necked, brawny, very busy, looked as if they might chew my ass for intruding and wasting their time. But within minutes, their gruff exterior dissolved, and they were warm, friendly, pleased to meet someone from back home. We talked mostly about sports. Can you believe the Yankees won it all again? How about that? None better. Yes, sir, none better. Then they told me their story. They were the first Americans I ever met who loved Japan. Stationed there during the occupation, they fell under the spell of the culture, the food, the women, and when their hitch was up, they simply couldn't bring themselves to leave. So they'd launched an import magazine, when no one anywhere was interested in importing anything Japanese, and somehow they'd managed to keep it afloat for 17 years. I told them my crazy idea, and they listened with some interest. They made a pot of coffee and invited me to sit down. Was there a particular line of Japanese shoes I'd considered importing, they asked. I told them I liked Tiger, a nifty brand manufactured by Onitsuka Company down in Kobe, the largest city in southern Japan. Yes, yes, we've seen it, they said. I told them I was thinking of heading down there, meeting the Onitsuka people face to face. In that case, the ex-GI said, you'd better learn a few things about doing business with the Japanese. The key, they said, is don't be pushy. Don't come on like the typical asshole American, the typical gaijin, rude, loud, aggressive, not taking no for an answer. The Japanese do not react well to the hard sell. Negotiations here tend to be soft, sinewy. Look how long it took the Americans and Russians to coax Hirohito into surrendering. And even when he did surrender, when his country was reduced to a heap of ashes, what did he tell his people? The war situation hasn't developed to Japan's advantage. It's a culture of indirection. No one ever turns you down flat. No one ever says straight out, no. But they don't say yes, either. They speak in circles, sentences with no subject or object. Don't be discouraged, but don't be cocky. You might leave a man's office thinking you've blown it, when in fact he's ready to do a deal. You might leave thinking you've closed a deal, when in fact you've just been rejected. You never know. I frowned. Under the best of circumstances, I was not a great negotiator. Now I was going to have to negotiate in some kind of funhouse with trick mirrors, where normal rules don't apply. After an hour of this baffling tutorial, I shook hands with the ex-GIs and said my goodbyes. Feeling suddenly that I couldn't wait, that I needed to strike quickly while their words were fresh in my mind, I raced back to my hotel, threw everything into my little suitcase and backpack, and phoned Onitsuka to make an appointment. Later that afternoon, I boarded a train south. Japan was renowned for its impeccable order and extreme cleanliness. Japanese literature, philosophy, clothing, domestic life, all were marvelously pure and spare, minimalist. Expect nothing, seek nothing, grasp nothing. The immortal Japanese poets wrote lines that seemed polished and polished until they gleamed like the blade of a samurai sword or the stones of a mountain brook, spotless. So why, I wondered, is this train to Kobe so filthy? The floors were strewn with newspapers and cigarette butts. The seats were covered with orange rinds and discarded newspapers. Worse, every car was packed. There was barely room to stand. I found a strap by a window and hung there for 7 hours as the train rocked and inched past remote villages, past farms no bigger than the average Portland backyard. The trip was long, but neither my legs nor my patience gave out. I was too busy going over and over my tutorial with the XGIs. When I arrived, I took a small room in a cheap ryokan. My appointment at Onitsuka was early the next morning, so I lay down immediately on the tatami mat. But I was too excited to sleep. I rolled around on the mat most of the night, and at dawn, I rose wearily and stared at my gaunt, bleary reflection in the mirror. After shaving, I put on my green Brooks Brothers suit and gave myself a pep talk. You are capable. You are confident. You can do this. You can do this. Then I went to the wrong place. I presented myself at the Onitsuka showroom, when in fact I was expected at the Onitsuka factory across town. I hailed a taxi and raced there, frantic, arriving half an hour late. Unfazed, a group of four executives met me in the lobby. They bowed. I bowed. One stepped forward. He said his name was Ken Miyazaki, and he wished to give me a tour of the building. We started at the factory, the first shoe factory I'd ever seen. I found everything about it interesting, even musical. Each time a shoe was molded, the metal last would fall to the floor with a silvery tinkle, a melodic clink-clong. Every few seconds, cling-clong, cling-clong, a kind of cobbler's concerto. The executives seemed to enjoy it, too. They smiled at me and each other. We passed through the accounting department. Everyone in the room, men and women, leaped from their chairs and in unison bowed, a gesture of K, respect for the American tycoon. I'd read that tycoon came from tycoon, Japanese for warlord. I didn't know how to acknowledge their K. To bow or not bow, that is always the question in Japan. I gave a weak smile and a half bow and kept moving. The executives told me that they churned out 15,000 pairs of shoes each month. Impressive, I said, not knowing if that was a lot or a little. They led me into a conference room and pointed me to the chair at the head of the long round table. Mr. Knight, someone said, here. Seat of honor. More K. They arranged themselves around the table and straightened their ties and gazed at me. The moment of truth had arrived. I'd rehearsed this scene in my head so many times as I'd rehearsed every race I'd ever run, long before the starting pistol. But now I realized this was no race. There is a primal urge to compare everything, life, business, adventures of all sorts, to a race. But the metaphor is often inadequate. It can only take you so far. Unable to remember what I wanted to say or even why I was here, I took several quick breaths. Everything depended on my rising to this occasion. Everything. If I didn't, if I muffed this, I'd be doomed to spend the rest of my days selling encyclopedias or mutual funds or some other junk I didn't really care about. I'd be a disappointment to my parents, my school, my hometown, myself. I looked at the faces around the table. In the past, whenever I'd imagined this scene, I'd omitted one crucial element. I'd failed to foresee how present World War II would be in that room. The war was right there, beside us, between us, attaching a subtext to every word we spoke. Good evening, everyone. There's good news tonight. And yet it also wasn't there. Through their resilience, through their stoic acceptance of total defeat and their heroic reconstruction of their nation, the Japanese had put the war cleanly behind them. Also, these executives in the conference room were young, like me. and you could see that they felt the war had nothing to do with them. On the other hand, their fathers and uncles had tried to kill mine. On the other hand, the past was past. On the other hand, that whole question of winning and losing, which clouds and complicates so many deals, gets even more complicated when the winners and losers have recently been involved, albeit via proxies and ancestors, in a global conflagration. All of this interior static, this seesawing unease about war and peace, created a low-volume hum in my head, an awkwardness for which I was unprepared. The realist in me wanted to acknowledge it. The idealist in me pushed it aside. I coughed into my fist. "Gentlemen," I began. Mr. Miyazaki interrupted. "Mr. Knight, what company are you with?" he asked. "Ah, yes, good question." Adrenaline surging through my blood, I felt the flight response, wanted to run and hide, which made me think of the safest place in the world, my parents' house. The house had been built decades before by people of means, people with much more money than my parents, and thus the architect had included servants' quarters at the back of the house, and these quarters were my bedroom, which I'd filled with baseball cards, record albums, posters, books, all things holy. I'd also covered one wall with my blue ribbons from track, the one thing in my life of which I was unabashedly proud. And so, "Blue Ribbon," I blurted. "Gentlemen, I represent Blue Ribbon Sports of Portland, Oregon." Mr. Miyazaki smiled. The other executive smiled. A murmur went around the table. "Blue Ribbon, Blue Ribbon, Ma, Blue Ribbon." The executives folded their hands and fell silent again and resumed staring at me. "Well," I began again, "gentlemen, the American shoe market is enormous and largely untapped. If Onitsuka can penetrate that market, if Onitsuka can get its tigers into American stores and price them to undercut Adidas, which most American athletes now wear, it could be a hugely profitable venture." I was simply quoting my presentation at Stanford, verbatim, speaking lines and numbers I'd spent weeks and weeks researching and memorizing. And this helped to create an illusion of eloquence. I could see that the executives were impressed, but when I reached the end of my pitch, there was a prickling silence. Then one man broke the silence, and then another, and now they were all speaking over one another in loud, excited voices, not to me, but to each other. Then, abruptly, they all stood and left. Was this the customary Japanese way of rejecting a crazy idea? To stand in unison and leave? Had I squandered my K just like that? Was I dismissed? What should I do? Should I just leave? After a few minutes, they returned. They were carrying sketches, samples, which Mr. Miyazaki helped to spread before me. "Mr. Knight," he said, "we've been thinking long time about American market." "You have?" "We already sell wrestling shoe in United States, in Northeast. But we discussed many time bringing other lines to other places in America." They showed me three different models of Tigers, a training shoe, which they called a limber up. "Nice," I said. "A high jump shoe, which they called a spring up." "Lovely," I said. "And a discus shoe, which they called a throw up." "Do not laugh," I told myself. "Do not laugh." They barraged me with questions about the United States, about American culture and consumer trends, about different kinds of athletic shoes available in American sporting goods stores. They asked me how big I thought the American shoe market was, how big it could be, and I told them that ultimately it could be $1 billion. To this day, I'm not sure where that number came from. They leaned back, gazed at each other, astonished. Now, to my astonishment, they began pitching me. "Would Blue Ribbon be interested in representing Tiger Shoes in the United States?" "Yes," I said. "Yes, it would." I held forth the limber up. "This is a good shoe," I said. "This shoe, I can sell this shoe." I asked them to ship me samples right away. I gave them my address and promised to send them a money order for $50. They stood. They bowed deeply. I bowed deeply. We shook hands. I bowed again. They bowed again. We all smiled. The war had never happened. We were partners. We were brothers. The meeting, which I had expected to last 15 minutes, had gone 2 hours. From Onitsuka, I went straight to the nearest American Express office and sent